Welcome to another episode of Grief Talk, everything you want to know about grief and more. I'm your host, Vaughn Solis. As an author, mentor, and bereaved mom since 2005, through guest interviews and coaching, here's where you'll always get great content that is inspiring and practical to help you heal after loss. Today's guest is Carol Brookings. After her mom took her life in 2013, Carol struggled with complex grief and guilt. She quickly realized there wasn't enough support for suicide loss survivors, which led her to the work she does today as a certified neuro coach and grief coach. Carol helps her clients find inner peace and joy after suicide loss using brain-based and science-backed methods that we're going to learn all about in today's episode. So welcome to my podcast, Carol. I have been so excited to not only have met you, but also welcome you to my show. And we have lots to talk about today. So I want to get started right after you pop in and say hi to my folks.
Yeah. Hello, everyone. It's so good to be here. Thank you for having me.
So for the audience, Carol and I met. She does offer an interview series for suicide survivors twice a year, and we're going to be talking about that towards the end of the show. But that's how we met. And I can tell you, I did join your Facebook group, Carol. We have hundreds and hundreds of people on it for suicide survivors. And you're very, very active. Holy smoly. And almost daily, I'm thinking. And you do a lot of live webinars. You pose a lot of really interesting questions. I want to clarify that most of your work, if not all of your work, is directed at suicide survivors. Is that right?
Yeah, so that's what I support people who've lost their loved one to suicide exclusively, really, yeah.
Yeah, and that's really good because, you know, when we niche down and clearly there is a need for more suicide support, we're going to be talking about that in this episode. So for the audience, just to give you a heads up, we're going to be opening up with a little bit about what Carol does so she can talk a little bit more about neurocoaching. She works in science-backed, brain-based neurocoaching, which I think is really incredibly important as a support to some other types of therapies. But we'll have a little conversation about that. Then we're going to be talking. Carol lost her mom to suicide in 2013. She's going to share a little bit about her story, hopefully about that and how that has impacted her as an adult suicide survivor. We're going to talk about your interview series for suicide support and your resources. But I'm sure we'll cover some other things. So let's get right to it. So, Carol, if you'd like to explain whatever you're willing to share with the audience about losing your dear mom, when and how that impacted you in terms of complex grief, maybe even some trauma. And then we're going to move into how it led you to do the work you do today.
Yeah, of course. So, like you said, I lost my mom to suicide nearly 10 years ago. So it was November of 2013. And it was a big shock for us. None of us expected it. I still remember receiving the phone call because I lived in a different country to my family. And I still remember looking back, I didn't really understand what it actually meant. I tried to make sense of it and it just didn't make any sense at all. So I flew to Germany where my family lived to so we can support each other and make all the arrangements and everything. But then I had to go back to the UK to finish my degree. I was in my third year of uni. Some of the things, especially at the start that I struggled with, or that sort of went through my mind, and I always like to share that in case other people can connect with that. So one of the things is I always look forward to falling asleep, and I was hoping and praying that I could be with my mom because that was the only way I could be with her now, right? And I dreamt about her sometimes, but not a lot. Another thing was I used to play what I call this game in my head where I said, okay, if I could go back in time only once, what would I do? How would I save her? And that took up so much of my attention, of my focus. It just kept running through my mind nonstop. I could do this. Yeah, but then that could happen. I could be there when in the right place at the right time, but it doesn't mean that she wouldn't attempt another time. And it, like I said, it was difficult for me to to be present. There's some of the things that I struggled with. I managed to finish uni and I started my graduate job. But again, the guilt that I was feeling was immense, because I felt like, you know, my mom came to see me in the UK for 2 weeks, just 2 months before she took her life. So I'm sure people can relate to the oh so obvious signs afterwards, right? When it's too late. So I was beating myself up a lot. I felt so guilty. I felt angry with my mom for sort of leaving us behind, right? When I would sit there and cry in the front of the lecture theater or at my parents-in-law's sofa, I always thought, you know, mom, because you did this, you took your life, that's why I'm sat here crying now. So that took me a while to work through. So like you said, it's a lot of complex emotions. And at the time, I tried to make sense of it and I couldn't. Another thing which I always find, again, not interesting, but I hear it happen to a lot of people, and it's just that strange feeling of, I remember standing in my kitchen and it was the 3 month mark, and I remember thinking, okay, it feels like it's only been 3 months and it feels like it's already been 3 months, both at the same time, which was just weird. And I definitely couldn't wrap my head around never seeing my mom again, like never, mm-hmm. such a long time. It just didn't make any sense in my head. And then that feeling of joy, right, where I've had experiences like my graduation where I knew technically they're joyful and I just couldn't feel it. I felt I had the ceiling of happiness right above my head. So it never sort of went anywhere. So they were some of the things that I struggled with.
Yeah. So a couple of things I just wanted to pop in here and say. So when your mom came to visit you 2 weeks in advance, because for the audience and for you and I, Carol, we haven't talked about this before, but you know, there's that last time we saw our loved one alive, and that itself can be a very traumatic memory, right? And I don't want to go into my last day with my daughter, but it was the day before she died. And there were I was feeling very triggered by a lot of fear about losing her that day. That's all I'm going to say, keeping it high level here. And I had no idea what was going on. And in looking back, yes, you can see all the signs of actually, in my daughter's case, saying goodbye. She was tying up her loose ends. And I just thought she was maturing, you know. But anyway, that's another story. But in terms of your mom visiting you, and you said, late, you know, looking back, you could see signs. So what were some of those signs? And we're not talking about this audience, so you can look for the same thing. But the signs are definitely there, Carol, and we're just not educated enough to look for them, right?
And I think it's also a case of, if we don't expect it, for those of us who don't expect it, because it's not on our minds, they're not signs at the time. What I always say is, we look back at everything in hindsight.
Yeah.
Knowing what has happened, and then we interpret everything in a different way, which is really not fair on us. But that's sort of, you know, what's happening there. And, you know, as you were talking, I'd like to share the last time I saw my mom. So she came to see me for 2 weeks, 2 months before she took her life. Mm-hmm. And I took her back to the airport for her to fly home. And I remember we were stood there and we got to the security area where I couldn't go through. And I remember she was hugging me and she started to cry. And I thought, well, that's a bit strange. Mm-hmm. But I thought nothing of it. I even remember talking to my partner afterwards. And I said, you know, my mom cried. But I said, well, it's just a mom thing, right? She probably thought she's not going to see me for a while. And then when it all happened, I said, oh, I wonder if she already knew she was never going to see me again. And then I remember her going through security and then standing on the other side of the glass, just waving goodbye. And that was it. I was off on the train home. So now, of course, you know, that crying I would interpret very differently. But also just things she mentioned, like, oh, you know, sometimes I feel like, why did I even bother getting up in the morning? And what I thought was, well, yeah, sometimes I would just rather stay in bed, right? Because again, it wasn't even on my radar, so I didn't interpret it in such a way. But those are just a couple of examples.
Yeah. Yeah. And for audience listening, that the idea of this talk, if you're tuning in, is I believe anybody can be at risk of suicide or being a suicide survivor. So I am very vocal and an advocate of everybody, you know, being aware of suicide, that it happens. It's not something that we should close our eyes and just, oh, I hope it never happens to me and never think about it, because it can, for every suicide, as a survivor, every one of us is surprised and shocked. I don't think there's one person that expects a loved one to take their life. I know we worry, but when it actually happens, they die alone. We don't know. And they may tell one person. In my daughter's case, she told her very best friend, but she did not tell her the day she was going to do it. Those girls had a pact, actually, and only my daughter went through with it. But I saw her as an example, a cleaning up, like, as I said, making amends with relationships that, you know, like a boyfriend she had dumped, for example. She apologized. She phoned me and told me what a great mom I was. You know, and I'm like, growing up, you know. So those are some examples of things that what I want to get across here. And Carol, I'd like you to speak about this just a little bit in your, you know, as it relates to maybe your coaching and helping others. When we are worried about somebody, I know maybe in your case you weren't. In my case, I was, but I didn't know what I was worried about. And there's a lot of parents that worry about their children, and especially in today, so a lot of mental health problems. But anybody at any age can be at risk of giving up, right? Giving into that, if it's an impulse, whatever we want to call it. And we don't know what, I don't even think psychiatrists have figured out what's going on in the brain at the actual moment of taking one's life. But if behavior, if we're worried and behavior, even if we're not worried, and behavior of our loved one is out of character, I think that is the moment we need to have the talk and sit down and say, are you okay? Are you thinking about taking your life? Do you have support? You know, a list of questions that we can have prepared, but just not being afraid to have the conversation. Because I believe, and Carol, I would love to get your opinion on this. One, if you have any tips about that. But two, if you are seeing in your coaching, in your Facebook group, and you know, in all of your professional area, that we just really, people don't, like, they really don't want to embrace the idea of a loved one taking their life. I don't know. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think you got right to the point there, that there's a couple of things as I talk with my clients and also in the group, as you've mentioned. Either the loved one maybe mentions they're suicidal, and then we think, okay, no, that can't happen, right? And then we just... try and throw all the tools at them and then say, oh, you know, don't say such a thing. And it's understandable, because we're worried, we don't want that to happen. But that doesn't really necessarily help them. And then, like you said, the other thing is, we're scared to ask that question. Mm-hmm. Are you suicidal? Are you thinking of harming yourself? We should say, are you thinking of harming yourself rather than taking your life? Because sometimes they don't even think about taking their life, it's just harming themselves. So there's a bit of a difference there. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so we're afraid to ask the question, because we think that's putting thoughts into their minds, but usually the thoughts are already there.
Exactly. And I'm so glad you brought that up, because I did an episode very early when my podcast started on the myths of suicide, taken directly from a psychiatrist. And they debunked, you know, I guess there might have been a group of psychiatrists doing the research, but medical professionals anyway. And the article I took it from, they debunked these myths. And that's exactly to your point. We're not putting ideas in their head. They've already got the idea. And this is one of the problems culturally in North America, for sure, that we need to get over. We need to be vocal. And I'm just going to throw this in here, and maybe I'll have a conversation with you again someday. But in Canada, we're both Canadian. And MAID, which is medically assisted death in Canada, is going to be one of the most progressive countries in the world. And as you may know, probably the law will be expanded and passed, I think it's next March in 2024, to include offering assisted dying for the mentally troubled. And they're even opening it up to, at least talking about opening it up to some minors who they are believed, who believe or are judged to be of sound mind. And it's shocking because essentially what it is assisted suicide for a mental health problem. I believe that we're going to have to change the conversation around suicide for people that take their lives and not through MAID. You see, because I'm thinking it's pretty much very similar, you know, and it's a can of worms at the moment. But another, I just want to mention that because we're going to have to, any way you look at it, we're going to have to change the conversation about what we think about suicide through, which is essentially medically assisted death. They push their, they punch their own button, you know, they click their own button and administer the lethal dose. And I know this is a really in your face conversation, folks, but that's what this podcast is all about. And these are issues that we're going to have to address. And so therefore I don't want to have the stigma, and I'm sure you don't, Carol, of having a loved one die by suicide. And it's just really, really an awful thing that we hope it doesn't touch us. And the other thing I just want to talk about really, really quickly with you here. It's really interesting because as a parent of a child who died by suicide and feeling terrible guilt. And so I was kind of interested when you said that you felt very, very, you know, I'm going to say probably complex guilt, if there is such a word, when your mom took her life. So whether you're a parent, whether you're the child, we feel responsible for our loved one, maybe even a spouse, you know, taking their life. And maybe all suicide survivors feel guilty. I think they do, Caro. But it's when Lisa Marie Presley lost her son, and of course she died early this year, January, right? And one of the things I came across when they were publishing some things in tribute to Lisa Marie was that before her son died, she was quite, in her own words, critical and judgmental about families who had lost, well, particularly their child to suicide. And like, what's wrong with that family? So in other words, having this association of dysfunction, your family must have been so dysfunctional that your loved one had to die. And I'm just throwing it out there for your thoughts. If you've, you know, come across any of that kind of problem in dealing with your coaching, because in terms of the guilt, we also have to struggle with thinking, well, I had never really thought of ourselves as dysfunctional until I read that. And then I thought, I'll bet you there's a lot of people who judge families who have lost a loved one to suicide, that there's something wrong with their family structure, their like something. What do you, can you say any, speak to that at all?
Yeah, so to answer your first question about the guilt, so not everyone feels guilty, actually. Some suicide loss survivors don't, and I always say that's perfectly fine. Don't feel like you should.
Yeah.
I think for me, I felt guilty because I wish I had been a bit kinder to my mum. Sometimes, you know, I get a bit stressed or wind up and I'd be a bit short with her, for example. So I just thought, oh, I wish I just could have been kinder. I wish I had asked the right question, or, you know, offered her some kind of support, those kinds of things. Because as the child of someone who takes their life, even though, you know, I was 23 and a half when she died, so I was still relatively young. Looking back now, I still felt, because I was an adult, I still felt I had some responsibility in it. I should have done something to support it. Of course, it doesn't make logical sense because I didn't know, right? But those are the things that can go through our minds. And in terms of like dysfunctional families, I mean, you're right. So many people judge as suicide loss survivors and their loved ones. And I think it's usually largely based on ignorance because they have no idea. And I remember before my mom took her life, I didn't judge people. I remember, though, when I heard about someone, you know, a friend of a friend kind of thing took their life, and I thought, oh, that must be really sad. And that's sort of where it stopped, right? I didn't understand all of the complexities around that. And that's why my upcoming interview series, which I know we'll talk about a bit later, all around having conversations around suicide and suicide loss for suicide loss survivors to be confident to show up and share their story, whatever they want to share, to reduce the stigma, to have those conversations, to educate the general public. So I think it's so, so needed.
Yeah, we're not going to have time to talk about that today, but it is a huge disservice to us for sure in our grief. And I don't, this is a question for you. So as a parent, I don't get it so much anymore, but in the first several years, and I was in any number of situations, how many kids do you have? And depending on who I was talking to, I would decide if I wanted to be truthful or not, right? Because it felt like I was doing such a disservice to my daughter if I only said I had my one child, my son. And then if I said, well, I have two, but my daughter died. Oh, how'd she die? And then I'd say suicide. And even before I got to the part about how'd she die, there would be an audible gasp and silence. And I always felt I needed to say, oh, that's okay. Now, that's a whole other story. I stopped doing that a few years ago. But when you talk about opening up the dialogue, the discourse for us to have freely to freely speak about our suicide losses, we also have to have not only the platforms, but we also have to have the spaces culturally to feel that we can do that. And the more we talk about it on any platform, in any type of, you know, support area that people are working in, and a lot of people are working in this, by the way, it's all a really good step, but we have a really long way to go. You're coming up 10 years in your bereavement. How did you, how do you now, if it applies, when people ask you something about, oh, is your mom this, or what are you doing for Mother's Day, or something, and then do you tell them, well, I lost my mom? And then if they say, well, how'd she die? Like, how do you help handle that?
Yeah, good question. And then, yeah, you know, I've done it before when, you know, even when people say, oh, are your family all in Germany? And I say, well, yeah, my dad and my brother are, kind of thing. Or if they say, oh, you know, has your mom ever come to visit you here? And I'll say, no, you know, she's passed away. And if they ask, I'll say that she died by suicide. And thankfully, we can't account for other people, but I've never had a really horrible reaction. I've had some, especially right at the beginning, I've had some insensitive comments where people probably didn't even know what to say, and they just wanted to say something, and you think, well, okay. But yeah, I'm just open and honest. But, you know, to make it clear, I wasn't always open and honest about it. So when I started my graduate job, people then knew that my mom died, but I didn't share with anyone apart from a couple of people that she took her life. I just didn't say it, and I think people didn't ask, though, to be fair. Mm-hmm. But then even moving on a bit later, so we had recently moved house. So, you know, you introduce yourself to your neighbors, and one of our neighbors come around and they say, oh, what do you do? And at the time, I was sort of moving from what I had done before, which was help kids with their math, to supporting suicide loss survivors. It was like a whole new thing for me. Mm-hmm. And when he said, oh, what do you do? And I just said, oh, I'm a math tutor. And I know it came out so quickly. I know it was driven by my subconscious. I didn't make a conscious decision to say that, but my brain, you know, the brain always wants to protect us. Yes. So I just say, okay, just say math. No one's going to question that. No one's going to ask that. And then I talked with my coach about it because I obviously recognized what was going on. And then we did the thing which I recommend anyone to do. If you know a situation is going to come up which you're not quite sure how to handle, make a plan in advance. So when it does come up, you already know what you want to say. So I knew we were going to go around to one more neighbor to, you know, introduce ourselves. So we made a plan, and I knew what I was going to say. And the question came up, okay, what do you do? So my heart rate increased, my hands got sweaty, but I already knew what I wanted to say. So I said it, And as soon as I finished saying it, my heart rate slowed down again. And all she said was, oh, I work from home sometimes as well. And that was it. So our mind tells us all of these stories of, oh, this is going to happen. They're going to say this. They're not going to want to talk to you, or, you know, they're going to judge you, all of these things. And that's not necessarily true.
Was this when you were being honest about working in suicide support?
Yeah, exactly.
Good for you. Good for you. I think people get a vibe from us how much we're going to say and at any one time. And I learned over the years just to really read the person. And well, I couldn't gauge their response. Nobody was like, oh, like awful. But they were always stunned and shocked. But I just want to tell you, Carol, really quickly, even just hearing you say, you know, like my mom took her life, my mom died by suicide, you know, however you're saying, even I'm still sitting here going, yeah, we're not really used to hearing that from people, not in, maybe in your world, but not in my world, just like we're not really used to hearing people talk freely about their child dying in any circumstance, and especially not the more, you know, difficult ones, such as suicide. I mean, you don't really, what parent have you ever met that's gone around, oh yeah, my child was murdered. Yeah. So, you know, it's like we have a ways to go. I think basically globally when it comes to the type of support and encouragement and survivors of tough deaths, and we're talking suicide today, being able to be to feel free enough to be authentic about who we are. Because the other thing I want to say about this, and Carol, I know you agree, and then we're going to go into your coaching stuff, is that the more we have to hide who we are, and huge life experiences that have literally changed us, it is the most inauthentic way to live. And it takes a heck of a lot of energy, and it makes us sick, and it makes us all sorts of things. And I have met people, I've been at this 18 years now, and I met people over the years, parents who were devastated and destroyed by losing their child to whatever means, and hid it. And some of these people are not a generation, but, you know, a few years older than me, and it has destroyed their lives, like destroyed them. And I've also met older adult siblings, say in their 50s, 60s, who lived as a sibling survivor of any kind of death, drowning, like accidental, whatever. And because it ruined their parents, it ruined the entire family relationship. And while we're not, again, going to have time to dive deep into the destruction of family relationships in grief, it is real, it happens, and without a doubt every relationship changes because the dynamic has changed, but it's something else that we kind of keep hidden and away. And I want to do some work on that so we can bring a voice to the things that are not being addressed in terms of rocking families, because it's not as simple as saying, well, no, just go to therapy together. No, this stuff can destroy families, and you've got to keep a really, really careful eye on surviving children if they have suffered sibling loss, for sure. And in your case, and I don't want to pry too much, but I heard you say you had a brother. Did you react similarly to your mom's death? Like, did it change the dynamic between you and your brother? Only share what you feel comfortable sharing.
Yeah, I wouldn't say so. Because I lived in a different country, we weren't particularly close, like talking all the time anyway, you know, when we needed to talk about something, we did, and that was fine. But I wouldn't say that has changed. None has changed. I would say with my dad, though, we actually got closer with my mom's suicide. We were supporting each other. So, yeah, it's certainly interesting. And to your point about, you know, not telling the truth, hiding the facts, there's a thing where you say secrecy breeds shame, right? So whether intentional or not, if we keep things hidden away, brings up shame, and then the more shame we feel, the more things we hide away. And the other thing, again, from a brain perspective, is it gets very confusing for your brain because it obviously knows what's happened, and then it keeps thinking, well, you know, you're telling a completely different story, which again is really helpful for your healing journey.
Oh, for sure. Carol, let's move into neurocoaching. I want to hear, obviously, you've already covered that, you know, the loss of your mom helped you find neurocoaching. I know that you used it for yourself and it was that light bulb moment. This is working. I've had them myself for trauma and stuff. So one thing I want to acknowledge right up front before we talk about neurocoaching is that you state that time does not heal wounds. You'll see many people or hear many people read about it, hear about it, that, oh, time will heal everything. That was one of the things that made me so angry when I first became bereaved in 2005. And by the way, when I became bereaved, I had no experience with grief other than losing grandparents, which as a child, which basically, I guess, did not affect me. So I was thrown full whammy into the deep end of the pool with the suicide of Janaea at age 22. And there was very little, and today there still is not as much support and books and help for support, like child loss and suicide loss for children and in, you know, specific areas. So unfortunately, not much has changed. And I want to acknowledge what I see on the comments on even your Facebook group, which is an amazing group, you know, and a lot of those people, followers and community, they seem to be newer to grief, a lot of them. And they're still struggling with stuff I struggled with 18 years ago. And that really kind of frustrates me, but I also understand it. And this is why we do the work we're doing, you and I, Caro, and others, okay? Because we need to change that conversation. We need to change the awareness. So in terms of, so people, time does not heal all wounds. It's what you do with the time that heals your wounds. So in the neurocoaching, the brain is so important, but I want you to talk, Caro, why is the is understanding the brain and even doing some therapies and methods that you use? I want you to sort of explain, you know, generally the neurocoaching. What is it sort of the methods based on, and why is it so important as you see it for grief?
Yeah, lots to share. So. Basically, the first things we get to realize before we get into this is about 90 to 95% of what we say and do is driven by our subconscious. So we think we walk around making all of these conscious decisions when it's really not the case. And I gave the example earlier when I said, oh, I'm a math tutor, and I know I didn't consciously decide that, it just came out. Another thing is that we're the creator of our thoughts, so we can choose which thought we want to think. And it's not like, I'm not going to send you away saying, okay, just think a different thought, right? That's not how it works. But again, an important realization. And also to know that not everything we're thinking is true and or helpful. Just as much as someone else, you know, they might say something doesn't mean it's true. It's something that I feel everyone should know about. But again, it's not something we learn in school or growing up. Right. Mm-hmm. So, and it's important in grief, because in grief, you know, if we've got the guilt and we've got the anger and we're blaming ourselves, they're all thoughts going through our mind. So we might say, you've lost your child. Oh, I'm a terrible parent. That would be a thought.
And it was.
You know, so if you have these kinds of thoughts, of course, it'll affect your whole life. So when we look at situations in general, we can say they're neutral, right? They just are. They're not necessarily good or bad. They are what they are. But then it, not until you attach a thought to that situation is when it can go either way. So for example, if someone says to you, oh, you should have moved on by now, right? One of those helpful comments. That's everyone in the room could say, yes, that person said that to you. That's the situation. And that's just fact. It's not good or bad.
Yeah.
But then we can attach a thought of, oh my goodness, you know, they say I should have moved on by now and I haven't. And that means I'm a terrible person, for example, right? And then I just follow that through and then we'll look at it from another angle. So then when you think that, oh, I'm useless, right? I'm not moving on. I'm stuck. And you're going to have emotions like maybe you've got anxiety or disappointment, sadness, those kinds of things. And if you repeat that time and time again, our thoughts and emotions, they create this deep-seated belief. So you really identify as a person who, you know, who's useless because, you know, you're not doing what people expect of you. Mm-hmm. And then based on our beliefs come all of our decisions, actions, and results. So if we believe we're a rubbish person, just as a general example, then our results will mirror that because our brain always wants to prove us right. Mm-hmm. Because then we can prove us right, everything's fine. Now, look, on the other side of things, say that the person said to you, okay, you really should have moved on by now. Mm-hmm. And you could attach a thought of, okay, they obviously don't know what they're talking about. Maybe they've never lost someone, especially to suicide. So I'm choosing not to even take that on. And then you might feel at least neutral. Maybe you feel peaceful because you're not letting it disturb you, right? And then your belief about yourself doesn't change. Maybe it even strengthens it, you know, you're fine as you are, for example. And then your decisions, actions, and results are based on that. And there's a great analogy, you know, about positive focus, which is different to positive thinking. Positive thinking is just, oh yeah, everything's great. Positive focus says there's the good stuff and the bad stuff. And you can only focus on one thing at a time. So I choose to focus on the good stuff. So if you imagine a miner going down the mine and they've got their headlights and the headlight only shines where they turn their head. So on one side, there's all the dirt and on the other side, there's all the gold, for example. So the miner could look to one side and just see the dirt and focus on the bad stuff. Doesn't mean the gold isn't there, but he doesn't focus on it. Or it could look the other way and see all the gold and focus on that. And we're not saying the difficult stuff isn't there. We just don't put our focus on it, right? Because what we focus on grows. Again, our brain's trying to prove us right all the time. So it will always bring up more of what we focus on.
So positive focus. Audience, that's fantastic. And especially for brains who have been traumatized. I have PTSD, so I zero in on things that go, oh, I like that. I can manage that. When we're the difference between when we're contemplating positive thinking, which because we don't always control our thoughts and most often don't control our thoughts unless you are very, very disciplined and trained to do it, versus positive focus. Now I right away go, I can do the positive focus thing. So I'm going to offer, Caro, love to hear your thoughts, but especially for people struggling in a newer grief, or maybe you've been in grief a really long time and are still struggling, right? Like I kind of have those people in sort of the same group. I think that working with this idea of just focus. I only have to focus. I don't have to think it. I just have to focus. I'd even offer that there's a little difference in the way we interpret thinking and focus. It's kind of the same thing, but it's all semantics, right? I'd let you speak to that. But if you say, well, I'm going to focus on the gold today. So all the things good happening, you can get out of bed, whatever that gold means for you, right? Do you agree that it's a more manageable process to take on or method to take on when you're really, really dealing with complex and like grief and even maybe trauma? Like when you came across this neurocoaching, did focus, positive focus change the way you viewed your grief and how like help in your healing?
Yeah, so I'll answer your other question first in terms of, you know, people new in their grief or maybe people who haven't done anything to process their grief yet. Yeah, you know, positive focusing and maybe gratitude, right? We talk about gratitude journals can be really helpful. Yeah. We know from brain scans that we can't be angry or anxious and grateful at the same time in that moment. That's why it's such a great exercise.
Say that again. Just a sec. Say that again, Caro.
We can't be either angry or anxious and grateful at the same time. So you can't be angry and grateful at the same time, and you can't be anxious and grateful at the same time. Because the areas of the brain work.
The thoughts are coming, or the emotion is coming from different parts of the brain? So do positive emotions come from a different part of the brain than negative emotions?
So it's just how the brain is all interconnected, that you can't have the one area and the other area both active at the same time. And it makes sense when you think about it, right? If you're really in a place of gratitude and you feel, oh, I'm so grateful for whatever, you're not going to be angry. You're not going to be anxious because you're sitting in that gratitude. And if you're angry, you're not going to be grateful for anything. If you're anxious and worrying about things, you're also not going to be grateful, right? Yeah. So when you think about it, it makes a lot of sense.
That is a key point to understand that, and this is why I love brain work so much, is because things happen that we don't necessarily have control over. Because you see, when you're working with positive thinking and, you know, and with all respect to life coaches, okay, all respect. But when you're thinking about it in terms of just going after the manifesting the positive, feeling grateful, and you can create whatever, there goes my headphones. You can create whatever you want just by the way you think, but that's not true. And in grief, this is where, and I lived like that for 23 years when my daughter died. So I know what I'm talking about. I did all the stuff from the 80s with the, you know, big manifesting gurus out there that became really big in the early 2000s. And so when I became bereaved and unbeknownst to me got PTSD, so right away my brain is now functioning completely differently. And I don't really want to say misfiring, but for lack of a better word, kind of like that. And I didn't have control over a lot of what I was reacting to because my brain had completely taken over to keep me in survival mode. So I did go through years of doing stuff that was the most bizarre behavior that I thought was like all I could do. And like, I don't want to go into detail, but just I worked at jobs that I had never done in my life before and thought like I could never, kind of like manual labor type jobs that I thought I couldn't do what I used to do. So whether my brain was tricking me, for sure, it was just telling me over and over and over again, you need to do what you are capable of doing in this moment to survive. And that was pumping gas and things like that. All due respect to people who work at gas stations and support work. All due respect to people who work in support roles. But that wasn't my background. And what I had done, you know, with my degree and everything, right? Basically in the business world, no. That world was no, you can't do that anymore. And it was years that I struggled. It took me years to be able to get back into that. And so all of this stuff about just think good thoughts, right? No. And this is why the brain science part of it is so important to understand, is because I think we really have to understand, first of all, know whether you've been traumatized and your brain impacted and how that's been impacted if you have a disorder. And second of all, even if you've just been traumatized but don't have a disorder, and I think we're all traumatized when we lose a loved one to suicide, Caro, right? It takes the pressure off us. The minute I understood I had PTSD and my brain was doing things on its own, it took all the pressure off me to try and be that person I was as a manifester before Janaea died. Right? And so it brings you a sort of a sense of relief, would you say?
Yeah, for sure. Because often we can think, you know, oh, what's wrong with me? And people will say they wanted to be the person that you were before. And then you think, you know, you're trying, but it's futile because, of course, you know, we've lost a loved one to suicide. We're never going to be the same person. And we're not saying that we'll be suffering forever. It just, things have changed, things have shifted. What's important to us has shifted. What our life will look like for the rest of the life that we get to live, it's all changed. And you know, it's another conversation around finding what's meaningful to us and how we want that to look, but we're never going to be that same person again.
So I do a lot of emotional based work. And And I've kind of turned a corner, and I'm working with an emotion wheel now, which is because we're emotionally illiterate. We're brain illiterate and emotion illiterate. And so putting the two together for me is so fantastic. I've worked with a couple, not worked with, but had a couple of practitioners on who are therapists who work in very much with the brain and understand the psychology of the brain and so on. And it's just so interesting because, as you said, and I know, but a lot of people watching to this or listening to this, and even your audience, may not understand the impact of the brain and how powerful it is keeping us surviving, which is completely different than choosing to live intentionally. And we can only live intentionally through choice when we understand what's happening to us with our brain and emotionally. And I just actually am releasing an episode on mastering your emotions in grief next week. And by the time this airs, I'll put a link to it because I combine the two. I think, and I'd love to know your thoughts on that. So I know that in neurocoaching, the basis of it is understanding, working with the brain and rewiring it, right? Refuting thoughts and so on. But is there also in your own practice and your own personal practice in healing, your own healing practice, do you pay a lot of attention to emotion as well?
Yeah, I think emotion tells us where we're at. Right. Yeah. And yeah. One thing that I find is that when we've got what we label a negative emotion, right, we don't want to feel it. We want to push it away. No. Mm-hmm. But really, what if we sat there and said, OK, I'm feeling this, what they label as a negative emotion. Mm-hmm. What is that telling me? Why am I feeling this way? Because that tells us a lot about where we might need to do some work or something that's activating for us. Right. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing, even though based on the brain and based on neurocoaching, the thought always comes first. Brain scans have shown us that the thought center fires microseconds before the emotional center of the brain. It can be so difficult sometimes to catch our thought if it was subconscious or if it, you know, was just there for a split second. But we usually were able to realize what kind of emotions we have. So if we've got resistance to something or we've just had a shift in emotions, if we can tune into our brain and think, okay, what have I been thinking about? What just went through my mind?
Mm-hmm.
It's such a great tool to work with because it takes some practice to be able to catch our thoughts. Mm-hmm. Because again, most of us, we think we pay attention to our thoughts and we really don't. Mm-hmm. So paying attention to our emotions is that great tool. And then once you've got the thoughts, we can go through the rewiring process and rewire our brain that way.
I would 100% agree with you that the why tells us where we are. And it's so important because as a person chooses, and I am a big believer based on lived experience and people I've met and so on, that we really have to choose healing. And healing isn't just going to wash over us, you know. And some people love to be miserable, okay? It's a fact. So those of us that are in work to help others, you know, we want to be working with people that want to improve their lives, heal, recover, heal. There's a difference, in my opinion, between recovery and healing. But, you know, ultimately, if you're going after I really want to be the best functioning person I can be, to be present for my loved ones, in your case, for your children, in my case, for my children, and for ourselves. It's easy to want to be better for someone else, especially like our children. Maybe some people want to be for their spouse or whatever, but I think we leave ourselves last, choose to be best for ourselves last. And so I'm just putting a plug in for that. Do this for yourself, folks. Understand the brain, understand the emotion, understand your why, and it can reduce conflict, right? In any given moment, when we're in dysfunction, we're in distress, we're in conflict, understanding what's going on with you emotionally and how the brain, what the brain is doing based on the thoughts. So what you're saying is brain-based, the thought comes first. Thank you. I was asking that in my coaching episode today. I'm not sure which comes first, the thought or the emotion, kind of like the chicken and the egg. And I'm going to now say, Caro said it's the brain. I mean, the thoughts. But at any rate, that makes sort of sense. So understanding that and then use it. use it daily if you have to, as a gauge. Okay, but here's what I do. And Carol, I ask you this too. You've been at this 10 years, so longer than some, you know, both of us, less years than others. But I respect and honor the bad I'm feeling, which is hardly ever anymore. But when it happens, I honor and I respect that equal to you're doing all right, you know? How are you feeling about that? Do you honor like the bad as well and just embrace it and go, this is what I got to feel right now?
Yeah, it took me some time to get there and rewiring my brain around that for sure. Like at the beginning, I didn't want to feel sad for days on end and cry and not being able to focus, right? And like you said, over time, as we process our grief, it gets less, like the waves in the ocean, they get less frequent, less, not as high. Yeah. Right. But yeah, for sure. Now I know if I've got a moment and I need to cry, I want to cry, I let myself cry. And I know that either, you know, in a few minutes or a few hours or the next day, I'm okay again. Right. Yeah. I think sometimes people, they're worried that if they start crying, they can't stop. But really, we all eventually stop, and it gives our body that release. It's really needed, right? We've got tear ducts for a reason. So we've been designed to cry when there's stuff going on that we need to release. So yeah, absolutely. It's a great place to get to just honor both of them and see the two sides of the coin.
Yeah. And when I made that realization, and several years ago now, it was around 2015, 2016. So, you know, 10, 11 years in, there was a turning point for me at 10 years. And I'd read about this a lot, that 10 years, something really kind of strange happens. I was like, okay, it's weird. So I'm not saying it's going to happen for you. I'm not saying it's going to happen for everybody. But for me, it was kind of like, okay, she's really not coming back. Really not coming back. And it's not that I had hope before that, but it was at a different processing. We'll see what I feel at 20. I love learning from people who have been in grief longer than me, but I can't always find very much information on that, especially for bereaved parents. But I'll talk to anybody who's in at 25, 30 years and, okay, how's the journey been? I love learning from others, and I'm sure you feel that way too, Carol. So this has been amazing. We can't go down any one of these topics too deep today at all, but it's just to twig the audience to the idea of this and understand that this is a long journey and process. And if your goal is to completely recover from grief in like a year and heal, 100% heal, more power to you. I have not been able to do that. And when I stopped forcing myself to make that the goal, then I became able to just really embrace all of my journey, the good with the bad, the disorders, the whatever. And prolonged grief disorder is a real thing. It just became a disorder last year. And prolonged grief disorder was described, if you go and look at it, as complicated grief that lasts for longer than 12 months and has impacted your life. So there will be millions of us living with this disorder. I'm not alone. And I periodically talk about it and bring it up because it's very, very interesting to understand that all of us have a lot of disorders that have done stuff to our brain, and we need to just be aware of that and be gentle with ourselves as we do choose to embrace a healing process. And I believe it takes several methods. It's not any one thing, in my view, respectfully. Well, that's the trick. It's a combination of a bunch of things, not even least stories and learning from each other. So, Carol, did I miss anything? Did you say everything you wanted to say about neurocoaching? I know we have to keep it a little bit high level today, but is there anything else that I may have missed asking you about that?
Well, yeah, just to keep it at a very high level, just if people wondering how the rewiring process works. So once you recognize an untrue and unhelpful thought, a negative self-talk, you want to write it down with pen and paper. And it's important to do it with pen and paper because it activates different areas of your brain than just typing or talking. So you're more easily able to bring stuff up from your subconscious. Mm-hmm. And the next step is the refuting. So there's a logical refute and the mirror refute. And if people are interested, they can you know, join the group or sign up to some of my series where I go into it a lot deeper. And then the rewiring actually happens by when we refute, we come up with those statements and then we record them on a voice recorder on our phone and we listen to it morning and night. And that's how the brain rewiring happens. So I want people to realize that, you know, it might not be nice to go through and to recognize those could'us and should'us and those untrue thoughts. But if we're willing to put in the work and trust the process, come up with those statements, the listening to it is it's not a big deal, right? It's a few minutes in the morning, few minutes at night. And that's when the rewiring happens. And I know it helped me. I know it's helping my clients. And in the end, if you're in a certain situation, you would normally have a negative thought, whatever. It doesn't matter where it is in your recording. The right thought will actually pop into your mind. It's really amazing. Yeah. And so just to give a level overview of that.
Yeah. It's really cool. We're at the top of the hour, Carol, and I want to talk next about your suicide interview series. If you want to share a little bit about that, those of you that are watching, listening to this, there will be an opportunity for you to register along with the episode we're releasing at pretty much the same time. But Carol, can you tell me the how it works, the intent of it for you to help people? I know you offer it twice a year. Do you want to speak a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. Thank you. So this is my fifth interview series that I'm going to be doing. And at the time of recording, we just voted in the group. I always like to get, you know, my followers involved on what topic should be next. And we people voted. And it's basically what we touched on earlier, right, around being confident to talk about our loss, to talk about suicide, to talk about suicide loss, to educate the general public, to reduce the stigma. What can we do, right? So when next time you're asked about your loved one's death or just about your loved one, you know what to say, you're confident, you don't, you know, start fumbling for words. Mm-hmm. And of course, I always say, it's your right to decide how much you want to share. So I'm not saying go out and tell the world, right? But it's just making sure it's aligned with your values and what you want to say rather than what comes up in the moment. So the interview series is a 5-day series. It runs Monday to Friday, and there'll be different suicide brief and loss experts on there each day. And people can register when you release this this episode, and we can put the link to register in the show notes. Mm-hmm. And the way that it works, once you've registered, is that, and it's completely free, you can choose to buy the VIP pass, which gives you lifetime access to the interviews, but you certainly don't have to. And then when you've registered, every day you receive an email with the links to information about the speakers and links to the interviews, so you can watch them. And then the next day, you can watch the next one. So you've always got 24 hours to watch each day's interview. And please join the Facebook group, because I'll be going live each day to answer questions, talk about my takeaways. I really love doing the interviews. It's one of my favorite things to bring all the experts to suicide loss survivors, bring everyone together and have that engagement. So, yeah.
It's amazing. And I was able to be part of Carol's speakers in May. It was the May, and I just loved it. And I watched all of your interviews, and they're amazing. So they're even great. I'm going to offer, if you're even trying to support somebody in suicide, you know, they're great. So thank you for that work. In terms of coaching, you do offer coaching. You have a wonderful website. So it's at carolbrookings.com. I'm going to have the links to that in the show notes. But you are doing coaching, so people can find everything and how to connect with you on Instagram, Facebook, inquire about coaching. It's all there at carolbrookings.com, correct?
Yeah, so they can find the Facebook page, Instagram, the Facebook group links there, and way to get in touch via my email address. And yeah, I offer one-on-one coaching right now, and I've recently started inner peace group coaching experience as well. So we can, you know, we can have a chat, see what works for you, see what you want to achieve, and we can see what which fits us best for you.
Yeah. So, you know, Carol, I just really want to thank you. I feel like we sort of almost just touched the surface today, and it's been an hour. And that just tells you, audience, how massive not only the topic of suicide support, advocacy, education, all of that is, mental health. It's something that we can never have too many voices. So I thank you for what you're contributing. This was, did not exist when I was in early grief in 2005. Do you have any last key messages that you want to share?
Yeah, I just want to say, you know, if the whole process of rewiring the brain, it's the first time you've heard about it and, you know, it's a bit much for you. Just even if you just start by paying attention to your thoughts and not believing everything that you think and everything that you say to yourself. That's a great first step because, like I said, most people walk around and they're just identifying with their thoughts and they think their thoughts are them, but it's really separate. We observe our thoughts. We aren't our thoughts. So if people even can take that first step, like I said, really paying attention to the thoughts and questioning them, they'll be well on their way.
I want to just say, as someone who is a bereaved mother and struggled with many bad thoughts, and you know, like to your point of you know, acknowledging that thought but questioning that thought and kind of like going, is that true? That would have been valuable advice for me in my very early grief, because my brain was telling me all sorts of things that were not true. Was I a bad mom? You know, and I struggled with that for years. This isn't like this went away in like a few months. This is years and years and years of doing all kinds of work on myself. So it's not easy, audience, to face these demons. But I love what you're saying, Carol, and tiny, tiny steps. And no doubt you offer all this kind of advice and guidance on Facebook as well. Join Carol's Facebook group. It's amazing. We'll have a link to that also. But what's the name of your Facebook group?
It's Healing After Suicide Loss.
Carol, thank you so much for coming on my podcast. It's been just a pleasure to have you, and I'm very grateful for the wisdom that you've shared today. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you for having me. And it sounds like we've got more to talk about, so maybe I'll be back sometime.
Oh, we certainly do. All right. Thanks again.
Yeah, thanks. Bye-bye.